Fritz Norris did, and the theme that looked good when I put it up on the board was macro, micro, or how high is up and how far is down or something. I don't know what we're going to talk about, but something like that, okay? Shortly after I retired, I picked up some few thoughts on a hobby that I thought I might want to pursue. And it was picked, really went back to my days in college. I started out at St. Olaf College, and then for financial reasons, couldn't go back for the next 2 years, went to a little school in Chicago downtown, right in the Loop, which was a different sort of an experience. And in the middle of the first year that I was there, that had been my sophomore year in college, I went to the only professor that I had sort of tuned in on, a professor of anthropology, Dr. Baltimore Junik. Fabulous guy, a kook, but it's easier to tune in on some of those kooks. Wonderfully alive kind of a person. And I said, I am going to drop out of school. And he said, why? And I said, because I can't, I don't know where I am. I grab courses without knowing exactly what they're all about or why I'm taking them. I'm heading for a theological seminary, hopefully and eventually, and there's no pre-sem program here at this school. They did give us 32, a class which supposed to be in marital hygiene, and really it was a course in 32 positions for sexual intercourse, which St. Olaf wasn't teaching at the time. And it was it's an extremely liberal, offbeat kind of a school. The Board of Regents was staying with a group from Chicago University's Board of Regents, sort of under the leadership of Robert Maynard Hutchins, whose name you may remember, some of you are a little older, who is doing some interesting and somewhat offbeat stuff in education and getting himself thoroughly loved by some people and thoroughly disliked by some others. But Hutchins got some of his members of his Board of Regents at the university to take over a little almost defunct YMCA college right downtown on LaSalle Street, a block from the Board of Trade building. And all of a sudden that thing took off like a skyrocket. It later became Roosevelt University, which some of you may know in Chicago. During the time I was there, it became Roosevelt University because the YMCA found out what they were teaching in this place and kicked them out because we're being too liberal. But anyway, I went to Dr. Junik and told him I was lost and couldn't find my way through this educational maze. And he said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, I'm not sure. That's why I'm saying I'm dropping out. I don't really know what I'm talking about either. But somehow or another, I'd like to find out the compass points of education so I can get some, so I can focus in on some direction. And he said, well, keep on talking and explain it. And I said, well, I want to know what's north and what's south, what's east and what's west. Explain yourself. Well, I'd like to know, for instance, what is the smallest and what is the largest? Because in 1932, in a little slick magazine that went broke after four issues, it was way too expensive to put out during the Depression. But 1932, this thing, what do they call it? I've forgotten. At any rate, in the middle of this thing, there was a centerfold, but it wasn't like Playboy's centerfold. It was different. But it showed, you know, you open it up, and it was about a yard wide on that centerfold thing. And down here, there was an atom, and out here was the sun. And it showed a few things in between the atom and the sun. But right in the middle was man, and then it said that in degrees of magnitude, man stood halfway between the atom and the sun. Presumably at that time, the atom and the sun were the smallest things known and the largest thing known. And the man stood midpoint in this. Well, I'm sure that that's not precisely and scientifically true, but it ticked off something in my mind. It would be kind of fun to find out where I am in this business. Obviously, I would come a little bit towards the sun these days compared to what I did in those days in degrees of magnitude. I'm a little bit larger. But then he said, all right, I think I can understand, but I said, I'd really like to fix myself spatially. And He said, but how about the East and West business? And, well, all right, what's the beginning and what's the end? What's birth and what's death? That's what I'd like to find. Now I've got North, South, East, West, if I got those four points, and place myself as operating inside of all of this. Well, he said, that's interesting, but don't drop out of school. We'll give you a leave of absence, and somehow or another we'll cover your grades for it, and go ahead and try it and come back and report it. What can I do for you? So, well, give me a microscope and some materials. So he set me up with that. And when I came back at the end of the afternoon, I asked him where I should check in the microscope, and then I would need it again tomorrow. He said, well, how long are you going to use it, for goodness sakes? I said, well, I want 2 weeks where I'm preoccupied with the very small by looking through a microscope. Then I would like to have 2 weeks looking through a telescope, reading about space, thinking, contemplating, meditating about the infinitely small and the infinitely large, and hopefully to come to some kind of an awareness of where I fit in all of this business, or at least to know that the space in which I really operate is bigger than the one that I think I have felt it was before this. And it does something to you if you look through a microscope for a while, and then in sharp contrast look through the telescope for a while, and expand the horizon, push them back a ways, and find that you're living in a much bigger space and existing in a much bigger space than what you had thought. Add to that some creational theology, and know that it comes out of your Father's hand, and no matter how far down you go by way of the new microscopes and electronic microscopes, smaller, way down there, which only suggests that there's so much more beyond that we'll never get to it going that direction. And then the same thing out in space. We're discovering new universes out there, new horizons out in space all the time, aren't we, with this modern technology. So he set me up down at the university so I could hang around and spend the nights looking through a telescope. I hadn't had a chance to do that again very much until I came back now this last week to Holden. I've been out here until 3 or 3:30 every morning looking through that little telescope that I have out here. And it dates back to that time. A little bit later, I'm going to throw some slides on that a few of you here have seen before. That'll show some of the stuff that I get preoccupied with when I sit down at my microscope. And not to learn something. I guess I'm not as against knowledge or learning as what I sometimes pretend, but almost. I'm more in favor of being and feeling and celebrating and some of those things. Mostly, I think, because we are so oriented in the direction of knowing more and accomplishing more that it bothers me. I think there's an impoverishment that takes place when we get so preoccupied. And we fail to be and to exist and to celebrate and to feel. And it's interesting that with all this modern exploration of space that's been taking place, we haven't quite come up with an improvement on the 8th Psalm, when I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained. What is man that thou art mindful of him? And the son of man that thou visitest him. And that was a shepherd kid who had no idea what those sparks up there in the sky were, except that they came out of his father's hand. That was a consciousness and awareness with which he lived. And I think this is what I'm trying to say, that we, somehow or another, we've gotten moved away from that consciousness of God in the broad expanses that go from the atom to the sun, or way beyond the atom below, way beyond the sun, going out the other direction. Well, birth. He said, how would you like to arrange that one? And I said, well, how about tie me in with a hospital someplace where I can watch babies born. I've never seen a baby born. So he fixed me up with Cook County Hospital. That's a, was at that time a typical county hospital. It is today a typical county hospital. Not much improvement. Poor people. So anything could go. It didn't perfectly all right to bring some stranger in and to enter into this rather holy place where a woman was giving birth to a child. Who cared? She was poor. So I watched babies born, 100 or 150 of them in a couple of weeks' time. And by all conceivable means, methods, some of them pulled out with something like ice tongs and very rather cruelly, and some of them very tenderly and some of them very naturally, and some of them by cesarean section. But if you're bombed with 150 births in a couple of weeks' time, somehow or another, something breaks through even the thickest of skulls, and you start standing in awe of the beginnings. The first thing I noticed out of this was that sunrises meant something different to me. I made an illogical leap and jump from the beginning of human life to the beginning of a day. Springtime later took on new meanings. This was when things were kind of getting born after the winter sleep. Some kids came to me one day and said, can you help me? That's when we were still living in Chicago. Can you help me? We have to turn in a paper for a science class and we don't know what to work on. What could you suggest? And after talking with them a while and getting acquainted with them, because they were total strangers to me, we suggested or decided that we would study, or they would study, and photograph with some equipment I had, some motion picture and still cameras. They would photograph 1 cubic yard of my backyard. Now, some of you heard me talk about a cubic yard of Holden here the other night, where I used to assign people to go out and find a cubic yard and they'd live in it for a couple of hours every day for a week or two, and just see what happens when you get intimately acquainted with 1 cubic yard of this creation and of yourself, more importantly perhaps. But at any rate, we set this up and they saw snow start to melt and the ice start to melt off the trees and photographed the little bubbles or drops hanging down from the trees with backlighting and with these little diffraction gratings that some of you know about, and the color is fantastic, blowing all over the place. And then they got down on their hands and knees and concentrated on a little motion in the earth, a little trembling, and then pretty soon an angleworm starts coming up out of it after the long winter sleep. They photographed buds as they were growing in time-lapse photography. Yeah. And I think it meant something to them, but man, I sure knew my backyard better after they had tuned in on this 1 cubic yard. We confined them to just that one tiny little space, and they couldn't photograph anything out of it except the sky and background and some of the stars at night that they put into it. Well, it wasn't only birth, you see, it was beginnings and then endings. 2 weeks. For 2 weeks, I watched people die. Now, not only just sat there and watched the babies born or watched people die, but read a bit about these two processes, and then did a lot of time contemplating beginnings and endings, as I had the small and the large. Just daydreaming about it, letting the mind go, just let it go. I wasn't trying to solve problems or memorize something or learn something, but just to sit in the presence of the small and the large, and the beginnings and the endings. Death, that was a hard thing. I'd seen some deaths. Last week, we talked a little bit about some of the deaths I've seen. When my grandfather called us all together and told us he was dying and wanted to talk to us and say goodbye to us because this was the day he was leaving, did it with that naturalness that some of the older people had. In the days before, we masked death in so many different disguises, including that of dread and horror, but the veils of drugs that so many times keep us from communication. Now, some of those are very merciful, and I hope to goodness if I'm in a horrible lot of pain, a few people will be kind enough to give me some of the great drugs that are out to alleviate this. But somehow or other, someplace, leave me a little peephole and a little window in which I can see my loved ones and hear them and perhaps say a few things to them in these great and holy moments of death. The one death that got at me the most, and I watched them die when they were on the emergency room carts. I watched them all mangled up. I watched them die in delirium tremens, toxicity of alcohol. I watched them die from cancer. I saw them die just from being old and worn out and tired of this life. The one that got at me the most was an old man. The nurses told me, now this fellow's never had a visitor. We really don't know who he is. We've got a name on him, but that's about all we know about him. And I sat with him for 2 weeks, every day for some time. And then when the hour of death drew closer, I was with him for 48 hours, sitting beside his bed in that dreadful loneliness of the abandoned human being. And maybe he permitted just a bit to tune in on the loneliness of it. But what a terrible thing to have to die with not one single loved one in the room, only stranger.
Was he lucid?
What?
Was he lucid?
Part of the time, yes. For the first week, he was lucid. First week, we could carry on a little conversation. The last week, he was pretty much out of it. But I talked to him because, by the way, glad this came up, by the way, in case you visit people in coma, talk to them, but don't say anything that you wouldn't say to them if they were wide awake, because they probably hear everything you say anyway. You better assume that they do. I've had people wake up. One old man, right shortly after I was ordained, down in Marshalltown, Iowa. One old man. When I walked into his room one day and said hello to him, and he said, "Hello, Pastor." And I said, "Well, I'm glad you're awake. You had a long sleep." And he said, "I guess I did. That's what they tell me." I said, "But I was here. I was here just the day before yesterday." "I know. You read the 32nd Psalm." Four or five weeks ago, I went into a little hospital we have in Leavenworth to see a friend. The nurses said, "Oh, she's out of it. She's been comatose since she came in 48 hours ago, and she can't understand anything." So I went over to her bed, took a hold of her hand, said, "Hello, Helen." And she squeezed it, but she didn't open her eyes. So I went out and told the nurse after I was leaving, I said, "She's not too far under. She squeezed my hand all." She said, "I don't think so. She's pretty deep into a coma. I suggested she not count on it." Because I'd heard these nurses standing in her doorway when I was walking in, and that's why I dropped back to see the nurse, and they were talking about some things that had nothing to do with this woman. And I think it's kind of impolite to carry on a conversation about your date last night in the presence of a person who now is in the crisis of the ending of life, and then to start talking about things that are certainly have to be trivial, certainly to the sick one. So I was hoping that I could kind of get through to the nurses a bit on this one. And then I walked, toward the door, and some other friends came through the door, and they said, how about Helen? And I said, well, she's back there, and she seems to be doing all right, but she's comatose. But talk to her. And if she doesn't answer, you keep on talking to her anyway. And so they went back there and did, and Helen woke up and said hello to them. That was enough stimulus from some of these others that she knew came in to just, well, haven't you been asleep? And you roll over and forget about it because some noise out here doesn't mean anything to you. Huh? But particularly when meaningful stimuli, like good friends, loved ones, the Word of God, something like that, meaningful, strong stimuli come, you can cut through very often and even get responses. But even if you don't get a response, perhaps it's only the motor part of the apparatus that is inoperative, and the sensory part probably still takes place. The loneliest moment, perhaps, that I can recall, sitting with this man as the pulse beat became fainter and fainter and respiration started to fade away. He went into something called chain-stroke breathing. And to sit there and know that nobody who knew this man had ever been to see him in this long hospitalization. He'd been there for 6 weeks. There's no way to die. In fact, I don't think hospitals are any place to die in first place. Don't go there and die to die if you can avoid it. Go home to die, where you can be surrounded by familiar sights and familiar things. You can touch familiar objects. Friends can come. Now, sometimes this is impossible because of management factors. Sometimes you have to have all the equipment of a hospital to keep you comfortable, even to be merciful to you. Or because the home isn't in a position to be able to handle some of the management problems of severe illness. But if you have a choice, for goodness sakes, talk it over with your family and say, hey, when the time comes, I want to die right here with you people around. I want to hear the clatter of dishes out in the kitchen when you're washing them, and I want to hear you people laugh, and I wouldn't mind hearing you cry a bit, but I don't want to die in the sterile atmosphere of a hospital. As sterile as can be. Strangers. Now, don't misunderstand me. I think hospitals have been evidences of fantastic blessing upon our generation, huh? With all the new modern technology. But somehow or another, we've gotten to the place where we substitute them for a lot of things that shouldn't be, like a hug. I'd like to die among loved ones and friends, maybe have a party that night or that day. It'd be fun to die in the middle of a party of some kind, wouldn't it, with all your friends around drinking coffee or Hans, maybe even some beer, huh? Huh? Even if I couldn't swallow it at the time. Well, you know what I'm saying. So I went back to Dr. Junick and said, here I am, and I haven't learned anything. Why? I feel as lost as I did before I knew what north and south and east and west was. Well, he said, we tried, didn't we? See, I'd been out of school now for 2 months. So I said, well, I think I'm going to drop out anyway. I'd like to just wander around and see if I can find somebody, or find me, or find some sense of direction. Well, he said, what's the problem? I said, well, maybe, and this was over a cup of coffee in the student dining thing, maybe it is that I forgot to deal with what is up and what is down. And he said, what in the hell do you mean by that? Only a theologian. I was a freshman in college, but he was calling me a theologian. I think the only pre-sem student this place had ever seen. What do you mean by up and down? So I said, well, I want to know what's good and what's bad. What's beautiful and what's ugly. What is profane and vulgar. And what is fine. Well, I don't know how we do that. leave me on my own. So I went out and I looked for the ugly and the vulgar. I did get Junick's help. I had an idea that the place I'd find the worst, the lowest of which man is capable, or women, or humans, would be riding with the Vice Squad in Chicago. Because man alive, these guys were picking up prostitutes and they were, you know, picking up the raiding, making gambling raids and picking up the drunks, and I would certainly get now immersed into the worst. Well, it was kind of interesting to ride around and have as part of my education, riding with the Vice Squad of Chicago. Somehow or another, these people didn't seem to be the worst to me. I felt sometimes that my first thought was that the police were the worst. They were terribly hard on some of these people. And I figured, it isn't the prostitutes that's bad, it's that vulgar, insulting, degrading treatment that they get from the police. That is even worse. Or when they picked up a drunk, threw him into the back of that sloppy wagon that's got vomit all over the thing. Somehow or another, I switched a bit. It wasn't the people that I thought were going to show me what the worst was going to be in life. And then it dawned on me one day that I guess I was the worst, because I had been now seeing the worst. Threw me in the tank. That's the place where they throw the drunks. This was by my permission, of course, and even my insistence that, hey, I'd like to follow these guys, these drunks, through the rest of this. Well, you know, what we do is dump them in the tank. All right, I'd like to spend the night in the tank. This was arranged. That was an eye-opener for me. Because I got in there, and here were a whole bunch of these guys, some of them sleeping, some of them staggering around, mumbling, vomiting. There must have been an inch of slimy vomit all over that floor of that place. It's made so that floor slopes towards a big drain, and they can flush it out every few hours, clean it up a bit. And then there was an old gentleman. I think that the technical term is Skid Row bum, who came up and put his arms around me when I was vomiting. I was vomiting. And he said, well, this is the way it is at the first. Pretty soon you can handle it better. He thought I was drunk and had been thrown in. They didn't tell him any different. He didn't know that I was vomiting because of their vomit, you see. On the other hand, there was a sort of a symbolic identification with it that took place, particularly when this guy put his arm around my shoulder and cared for me. A week later, I had somewhat the same experience when I was thrown into the Bridewell, which is that lousy old jail they had in Chicago. I hope they burned it down. But it was a horrible place. And I got put in there. And after the lights went out, there was somebody two cells down from me who said, quietly, young man, is this your first time? And I didn't know who he was talking to until my cellmate said, he's talking to you. So I said, what did you say? He said, is this your first time? I said, yes, it's the first time. And he said, well, some of us will stay awake tonight. We usually do when kids come in here for the first time. And I don't remember better pastoral care, if you want to stretch your terminologies a bit, than I received in the Bridewell. Guys sitting up all night just so I didn't have to be lonely and terrorized like they remembered being when they came in the first night. And that gave me a thought that maybe the best and the worst aren't that way and that way, but somehow or another, this thinking in polar opposites is deceptive. And maybe things get curved around and best and worst kind of get confused at some point in the middle of a night in Bridewell. Or on the cross. Where he who knew no sin became sin. So it's a little hard for me to talk about smallest and largest and even birth and death or about good and evil in terms of their separation and their apartness. And I guess even now that, you know, death isn't more than 40 years away from me. I'm going to die sometime in the next 50 years or 40 years, maybe even sooner than that. I'm glad that I heard St. Francis say that it is in dying that we're born. Just as surely as when we're born to death. Somehow or another, something is going around that is more like a circle than it is like a plane. Well, I thought when I left the hospital that I might like to start a little community, a true university, where instead of having a whole bunch of separated departments, which I think is a contra university, that you bring things together in a more unitary way. I'd like to have 24 students who could stay with me for a couple of years, and we would together spend 6 months, say, looking at the smallest and meditating about it, and not going to India for a guru. I don't think we need them from that far away. I think we can cultivate the art of meditation and contemplation and quietness and stillness and develop the art of being to balance off our fantastic achievement in doing. I'd like to have some babies born in this community and perhaps bring some in who could die for us so that we could learn from the dying what it is to die. Like Richard Cabot, who I mentioned, I think, was it yesterday sometime? Prominent doctor. Had such an influence in my life. Who taught his last course from his own deathbed and stayed home and out of the hospital in order so he could make it more convenient for his students. They wouldn't have to cross town to get to Massachusetts General Hospital. They could be there while he told them what it was like to die. Well, I want to show you some stuff. That'll give you an evidence. You know, we're out here at night, and if any of you are foolish enough to stay up, boy, the only things that I can show you right now that are worth looking at are the moon and Jupiter. Well, I shouldn't say it that way because these are pretty good friends, and they are nice. And the moon is going to be nice tonight because the moon is now going away from this horrible full moon thing where you can't see much of anything. It just blinds you and it pales out. You don't see a great deal. But now that the Terminator is moving in and in, now it's probably about 2/3 of a moon tonight, something like that. And the light's coming across the craters and the craters stand up and you can almost put your finger down into them. Drink out of them like a coffee cup or something, except that it's terribly dry up there. And then just kind of remember that that moon is one of the smallest things in the whole universe. In fact, Earth is one of the smallest things in the whole universe. We'll look at Jupiter with its moons tonight also, if it's clear. And Jupiter is enormous compared to the Earth. It's, 385 times the size of the Earth? Spins so fast that if it was the size of the Earth and still revolved the same way, it would take, our days would be 2 hours long or something like that, maybe a little bit less. because it's spinning so fast up there. Telling somebody last night or night before that if you pass that way someday, don't ask to stop off and walk on it, because it's nothing but gas. That's all it is. And you'd have a hard time walking on it. But it's a beautiful thing. And somehow or another to get caught up in the mystery that's even in these near-in objects, because these are right here in our backyard, relatively, huh? So it's about the only thing we're doing in these three sets of opposites that I've been talking about a bit this week, are a little opportunity to look through the telescope. It's even better not looking through the telescope, by the way. If you want to save yourself some sleep and be sensible, just get out, but do it by yourself. Get out alone. If you can find a place to lie down, better. There's a great place up at the top of the circle, you know, up at the top of that road and along the chalets. Take a blanket along with you if you don't like to lie on the ground. I'd suggest that you leave the blanket home and just get acquainted with where you're going to go someday. Get on friendly terms with this earth by hugging it a bit. But if you would rather ease into that, bring a blanket along, stretch it out, and then just look. And if you can find a place to do this by yourself, it's probably better. And see if a little bit of a mystery doesn't come rolling in. Facts are nice. I get a little annoyed when somebody says, how far away is it? Because we're all tuned in on getting the facts of things, aren't we? Instead of experiencing them, feeling. Well, to give you a little possible taste of the other side, I'll throw some slides on here. Some of you have seen Larry Collins' slides. They're magnificent. Larry Collins comes up here. I've been for years and years. And Larry, as a geologist, has got a great, big, fancy piece of equipment that he can slice rock so thin that you can't believe it. And then he puts these under a microscope, and with a process called cross-field polarization, he uses two polarizing filters, one down below here, then the slide, then the lenses, and then the ocular where you look down, and another polarizing filter at the top, and you cross the polarization. So that one polarizing filter is oriented this way and then one this way. And when this happens, it causes the crystals, certain kinds of crystals, birefringent crystals, double refracting crystals, to explode into fantastic colors. You don't put the color onto them, you just allow the color to come out of them by this process. It's a way of seeing the color that's characteristic of the crystals. You can tell the difference between the crystals by the colors and by shapes combined when you do this process. And I have spent more hours than I suppose I would care to admit to just staring down into a microscope, not caring if I learned one single thing, but just for the sheer joy of seeing the beauty that is hidden and you never pay any attention to it. You might put some sugar in your coffee, but I'll bet you have never known how beautiful sugar can be. You put some salt maybe on your food, and it is fantastically beautiful when it's subjected to this kind of process and you throw it on the screen. Epsom salts, of all things, huh? Aspirin, citric acid, a little orange juice. My urine. Got some slides of my urine. Beautiful. The hospital I worked at, I'd made a 16 by 20 enlargement of some stuff that they had extracted from my urine. And in the kind of the executive washroom, I put one up over the John with a caption underneath, "Think twice before you flush." Oh, there's so much that is hidden. And I don't... God was so It's so extravagant. Just think of all those things. We haven't even seen any part of it yet. We've just barely touched, I suppose. But every day that goes by, every new technological advance in looking towards the smallest or towards the largest just shows us that we ain't seen nothing yet. And so much of this has been hidden, hidden, hidden from the beginning. We're permitted to see a little bit more every once in a while. And it gets wondrously exciting. Perhaps when we no longer see through a glass darkly, then face to face, it won't only be the improvement in the interpersonal relationship, but it may be also that we will be able to see 80 zillion miles down and 80 zillion miles up or whatever.